My name is Karen Sloat, and I am teaching today on harassment and discrimination prevention training for ministries.
What happened to sex?
We will talk about sex, Jim, just later.
Okay.
Later. I'm wondering why people are attending. In fact, I will note for the recording, there are only men in the room, so maybe I chose the wrong title.
Taking notes for the
All right, so we're here for harassment discrimination prevention. We are not here to learn how to harass. Just have to make that clear. This is harassment prevention training. Why are we doing this? Well, you may be here out of the goodness of your heart because you heard Walter Kim and you think, my heart's completely clear of discrimination, but I'll just help Karen out by attending. What we do under the law is we attend harassment training to comply with the law. The law calls discrimination illegal, right? And so today my goal is that we learn what constitutes harassment and discrimination, understand your responsibilities, not only as an employee, you may be an employer, you may be a leader, you may be a supervisor, and then we're going to review some sample policies. Now, the really cool thing about you coming today, as opposed to yesterday, is I have an email sign-up list, and if you sign up today to get the handouts, which I'm going to describe later, you will also get a certificate of attendance. You may think, woo! But if you get a certificate of attendance indicating that you have completed harassment and discrimination training, actually some insurance companies like to see that, and they may affect your policy premiums, or at least show that you are a progressive employer ministry with preventative tactics. So here's a handout for your sign-up. I was so moved today by Walter Kim's presentation. I thought he presented a theological discussion of discrimination, and really, you know, we could do that today if I were qualified, but I'm not. But it's such a wonderful intro to this seminar, looking at, you know, why is there still harassment and discrimination in our country, in the world, and, you know, what do we do to prevent it? What I'm going to be talking about today is what the government imposes upon us to try to get us to prevent discrimination. Obviously, this does not go to the heart, but hopefully this will help you in training your parishioners. I want to start with a quick prayer before the seminar. I know we're starting a little late because of the schedule, but I want God to lead us. Lord, will you come, make your presence clear? Will you talk to our hearts, touch our hearts in a special way, not only to change us as individuals, to stop with our biases, stop our discrimination, but Lord, show us what you want us to know out of this presentation that we can take forward for the purpose of the gospel, for the purpose of either cleansing our congregations from discrimination, making them more lawful, making them more open and welcoming. But we seek your purpose, Lord, in whatever it is. And I ask that you'd use me as a mouthpiece just for you and have people take away what they need from this seminar. Thank you so much for your gift of love in Jesus' name. You think sexual harassment claims are increasing? How many think sexual harassment claims are increasing? Everybody. Well, actually, they are decreasing. In 1980, remember the Clarence Thomas issue? That was the main focus for so much time, and that kind of woke us up to sexual harassment. The number of sexual harassment claims is actually decreasing in most states, certainly in California. You can see the EEOC, which is the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. That's the federal arm of a federal agency that governs discrimination claims, has had fewer sexual harassment claims, but many more men are claiming sexual harassment. The annual sexual harassment claims in the EEOC from California are 7,000 of the total of 40 or 50,000. Most are from California. I know that'll shock you. The sexual harassment claims have decreased. We talked about the men, the number of men increasing. But in 2012, they received almost 100,000 claims. Now, the EEOC can receive your complaint, but also there's usually a state agency that can receive your complaint of sexual harassment. We'll start talking about sexual harassment. We'll talk about discrimination later. But you can see that 52% of all the complaints that go to this agency are determined to be without reasonable cause, especially in California, but nationwide. That means that the EEOC looks at the complaint, looks at the facts, calls the witnesses, looks at all the evidence, and determines these people don't really have a complaint, a valid complaint of discrimination or harassment.
So Karen, so is what being counted, the actual claims that stand, or any complaint at all?
Good question. These are the only the complaints that are filed with the EEOC, which is could be anyone in the nation filing with the EEOC. It's those complaints that are put in writing that are being counted.
Okay.
So any complaints, they evaluate them and determine what percentage of reasonable cause. And I'll back up a little bit. All laws of all states, as far as I know, require that there first be a complaint filed with an agency before someone can go to the courts about any discrimination or harassment suit. The agency must first either investigate or issue a right to sue notice, which allows that plaintiff to go to the courts with a lawsuit. So that's why the EEOC's position is so interesting. They're finding that a majority of people are making up these claims. Why do you think that is? Money. And I'll tell you, it's attention. Sorry?
To get back at somebody's
own. Right, exactly. It's some personal goal. Professional women are harassed apparently more than subordinate women, and lots in the restaurant industry. So unlawful harassment, you need to know, only falls under the discrimination laws of the state and the country. So so harassment in and of itself, somebody being mean in the workplace, somebody calling you up on the phone, harassing you over and over, those types of claims are not what we're talking about today. These are employment claims that fall under the employment protections of the discrimination laws. So if someone says, I have a hostile work environment, I'm going to sue, you can't sue unless you have, unless you're in a protected category under the discrimination laws. I'll be talking about that a little further, but just to give you a headline. In California, the harassment need not be motivated by sexual desire. This was the case of same-sex harassment up until, believe it or not, the end of 2013. A man couldn't successfully complain and receive damages for harassment by another man. There was no same-sex harassment unless the person harassing was motivated by sexual desire. So let's say another gay man was harassing the victim. The government has decided in our state that harassment need not be motivated by sexual desire. This was a case where a straight man was harassing a gay man in the workplace, and the gay male was able to recover. Unlawful harassment can be used to affect any terms of employment. So again, we talked about discrimination laws, harassment. Those laws cover the employers in the state. If an employer demotes someone, moves them to a different department, suddenly changes their job description so they have fewer responsibilities, those things can be evidence of discrimination or harassment in the workplace. The Title VII is the federal law, the Civil Rights Act. We've discussed it in Pastor Kim's discussion. And Title VII is the federal discrimination law that protects certain categories and covers religious entities. So if you're remember anything, you're governed by Title VII if you're a religious organization in the United States. Religious organizations are exempt under Title VII, so that in certain cases they are not obligated by the discrimination laws. We'll be exploring that a little bit. The Keys to California statute, which I'm going to take a few slides to talk about, is the Fair Employment and Housing Act. In each of your states is some kind of anti-discrimination act. Ours is the Fair Employment and Housing Act. It's very strict. It's very employee favored. But it does have a religious entity exemption. In other words, under the Title VII and our state laws, an employer is exempt if they are a religious organization. They still cannot discriminate based on certain categories, which we'll discuss, but they aren't even defined as an employer is covered for all categories. So be sure to look in your own state and see what your exemption is for your religious organization. 1980 was the beginning of the EEOC's regulations, determined that the sexual harassment was a form of job discrimination. All right, let's talk about Title VII. Title VII prohibits discrimination based on race, which was discussed this morning, color, religion, sex, or national origin. Title VII does not go into a number of categories that California and other states prohibit for discrimination. Title VII has two exemptions, the religious organization exemption. If you're a religious organization, you have a statutory exemption. You're not an employer covered by this act. And the ministerial exception, which we'll discuss, is if you are an employer in a religious organization and you have ministerial employees, we talked about this a little bit yesterday, if someone can be assigned as a minister of your sect, your religious creed, then that person is exempt and cannot bring a claim for discrimination. Sounds crazy, but we have a very famous case on that issue that we'll be talking about. So Title VII exempts a religious corporation, association, educational institution, or society with respect to the employment, as long as it carries on the religious activities. Now, this is the law. I will tell you that right now, this law is being challenged. And in California, we are experiencing a legislative act. It's known as Senate Bill 1466. It's passed the Senate. It's heading to the Assembly on August 5. And it completely obliterates this as to Christian educational institutions. They would be, despite Title VII, despite the state law, would be required to teach on transgender, bisexual, gay issues, despite this exception. The ministerial exception falls on our freedom of religion, constitutional right that churches have, that religious organizations have, that we all have to practice our religion. And if persons are identified as ministerial or truly ministerial, then Congress, the state, has no right to govern how we treat those people, believe it or not. Even if we treat them for a disability, if we discriminate against them for a disability, the cases have said if they're ministerial, the religious organization has the right to decide who will stay and who will go.
About how long do you think it will take to fight that?
It's being fought right now. Yep, right now. Right now, in fact, I'll divert a little bit. There's an unmarried lesbian teacher. She called herself a pastor. She signed a statement of faith. I'm a Christian. She's a teacher of the religious organization. This is in Ohio. She was was carrying out the message, as we discussed yesterday, carrying out the message of the religious entity. But she and her partner got an artificial insemination. She's pregnant. And the Lutheran organization terminated her. And now she's suing. Currently, in California, in Ohio, I believe it is, she has won at the state level. They've determined that despite the fact that the statutes protect the religious organizations and allow them to discriminate based upon the statement of faith, the discrimination against her was unlawful. And she's won a big damage award. It's now on appeal. So Jim, it's imminent.
Where in there, that's like blowing in the wind as far as she's concerned, or as far as I'm concerned about her. What part of this, though, is going to make it mandatory for the schools to start teaching transgender?
Okay, and that's a California statute. That's a California law. It's a Senate bill that's been gone through the legislature. The California Senate has already approved it. And it's a law that requires that any religious educational institution that receives federal funding must teach on those issues.
Like Biola?
Biola is the one that's kind of leading the charge. Mm-hmm. And of course, Biola not only receives some federal funding, but its students receive federal loan assistance. And many religious groups are banding together trying to stop the assembly from passing that bill because that would mean either the school says we will not teach on these issues that violate our statement of faith, and then the students don't get the funding, and the school doesn't get the funding, or they must teach on those issues in order to get the funding.
So what you're saying is that every school, at least elementary to high school, is going to, because they have ADA, the average daily attendance, and they get money from that. So that means they're going to be hooked into that also.
It certainly could be. Christian schools are at risk right now. This is Christian higher education. It's going to trickle down.
Can we fire them?
Can we fire the entire legislature?
Well, hey,
sometimes
hey,
I would love to.
One thing from my perspective, a lot of the things that are happening are determined by people in black robes.
And we fire them?
But this is
why the election matters so much. Because, you know, when it gets to the Supreme Court, whether we have a constitution left or not is going to be decided in this election.
Right. I mean, and these cases I'm going to talk about, Hosanna Tabor is the strongest one for preserving our religious liberty, and now the court is 4-4.
Yes.
I mean, all these cases I had researched up until now were, you know, keeping our freedom of religion, preserving our freedom of religion. But now the court's up for grabs. All right. The general rule, this is encouraging so far. I have to tell you, this is up until this last month when this case came down and this legislation in California. But the position that's important to the spiritual nature of the church or the ministry has included, under cases that have already been decided, a non-ordained or associate pastor, a lay choir director, member of university, canon law faculty, and faculty of seminary. In other words, discrimination against those persons for any reason has been found lawful because the church or the ministry designated their positions as ministerial, key to the translation, the communication of the message, and therefore we have freedom of religion that the state cannot interfere with. Spencer versus World Division has been a big case that, again, stood for our freedom to exercise religion. Three workers were terminated when they denied the deity of Christ. It's a humanitarian organization. Humanitarian organization, World Vision, terminated them. They sued and said, no, we have a right to believe whatever we want to believe. We're not in a ministerial position. They determined, the court determined, that World Vision would be permitted to discriminate based upon their statement of faith. We think that's obvious, right? These people denied the deity of Christ, but it was only because World Vision had the proper documents in place and had made it a condition of employment. Hosanna Tabor was a great case that came out in the U.S. Supreme Court several years ago. They acknowledged that ministerial exception. This was a teacher in a Lutheran school. She was clearly assigned and called position to carry out the message of the Lutheran organization. She took off time after a disability and then tried to return to work, and they said, no, you didn't give us enough paperwork, and terminated her. Now, we don't really know the reasons that they terminated her, but she sued for disability discrimination. Now you think, well, churches shouldn't be able to discriminate against people because of their disability, but in this case, the U.S. Supreme Court determined that they could, because the ministerial exception keeps the state out of the church. The ministerial exception, as a minister, she was in a designated position that was covered by the freedom of religion. If she had not, and this is a long description, Justice Roberts and other justices conflicted on this, but it was a long description of what is ministerial. We talked about this a little yesterday for those of you who weren't here. Someone who is carrying out the doctrine, teaching children the doctrine, those positions, administrators who are guiding the policy of the religious organization, those are clearly ministerial positions. I strongly recommend job descriptions that lay out their ministerial, you know, participation in chapel, training in the Bible stories, that kind of thing. But assistants, teachers' aides, preschool teachers, people on the doing yard duty, the janitors, may not be ministerial. And then they could sue you for almost any type of discrimination and probably be successful. So the takeaways from the Hosanna Tabor and the Spencer decisions are that as of now, the ministerial exemption is still preserved. To determine whether someone is ministerial, we look at the function and the good faith identification of that person's job duties. So if you're in a ministry and there's no job description, it's time to make one. Just a couple of decisions since Hosanna Tabor. We talked about the call teacher at the Lutheran school, and I thought it was interesting that the lay music director and piano player was determined to be ministerial because the piano playing was such a part of the worship of the organization. All right, let me talk about FEHA because we have a ridiculous law in California. Ridiculously oppressive. FEHA, of course, prohibits discrimination and harassment, but as of this year, we've just added to FEHA. This was the bill that was passed March 28th. Actually, it wasn't a bill. It was from the Fair Employment and Housing Agency, Department of Fair Employment and Housing. Just a state agency, almost no oversight. They had a couple hearings. They discussed it over some months with some authorities and then put a law in place, regulations, March 28, effective April 1. And by April 1, all employers had to put into place policies on transgender, bisexual, same-sex protections. And this law expanded the employment laws of the state of California to applicants, independent contractors, volunteers and interns. In other words, everyone's protected from discrimination. It sounds like a good idea, but if you think about it, the employer's not paying the interns, has no direct supervisory control over the interns, or contractors, but all these people are protected to the extent that the employer can be sued. Language in the workplace. How about language in your workplace, in your ministry? The second language is must be permitted. There are all kinds of articles. I have one here, the use of English-only policies in the workplace. Previously, the EEOC said as long as there's a reasonable business decision for requiring English, it's fair ground. For example, in a preschool, if the teachers start talking Spanish or Filipino or anything, you know, Tagalog, to each other, pointing at the parents, pointing at the children, that there's always been a business reason for having them speak only English, so that the parents don't feel excluded, no one feels attacked, co-employees don't feel defamed. But our wisdom in California is that now it's the opposite. You can't restrict any other language unless you meet all kinds of criteria. All right, so the FEHA protected categories, again, in the Title VII, we saw about six or seven categories. We have, I think, almost 20. Age, not youngsters, just people 40 or over. Well, you can read them all. I don't need to read them to you. Disability has been expanded. Genetic information has been expanded. So if you discriminate against someone because they had cancer in their family, because they have HIV in their circles, those are no longer permitted. Gender identity, gender expression, sexual orientation, interns, volunteers, etc. They're much more expansive than under federal law. And driver's license. Now there's a classification, protected classification, for those who don't have a driver's license. Probably an attempt to protect the aliens who have come into the state to work, but an employer can't refuse to hire someone if they don't have a driver's license.
Even if the job involves driving?
If the job involves driving, that's a business purpose that overrides the consideration. For now, that's right.
So how do you know who you're hiring?
Exactly. Well, they can produce a Social Security card, may or may not be a real one, another photo ID or not. Gender expression, gender identity is now clearly defined. These are the specific definitions from the regulations that must be posted on the wall of every employer in California, at least every secular employer. Again, religious organizations covered by Title VII. They're exempt under the Fair Employment and Housing Act. However, the way things are going, if this Senate Bill 1466 goes forward and there's more dilution of our rights, we're going to have to teach on these items. Discrimination and retaliation are unlawful conduct for which an employer or a company can be liable. I want to tell you that harassment, though, is something that can result in personal liability. So the part of your training, I hope you go back to your religious organizations and train, find someone to train. If someone is found liable for harassment based upon any of these protected categories, they could be personally liable, even if it's in the workplace. That means that your personal assets are at risk. Any questions about that?
That's okay, I don't have any.
You don't have any personal assets?
My wife
okay.
With my Costco card.
Okay. Our state laws are broader than Title VII. Of course, we just discussed the expanse of the protected categories, and also that it's expanding to interns, volunteers, etc. I don't know what your state provides, but you should check. So let's talk generally about what is actionable harassment. It's based upon an employee's protected status, as we talked about. It's not just the loss of a job benefit. There are two types. So just remember, I know all this is kind of complicated, but there are two types: quid pro quo and hostile work environment harassment. Quid pro quo is the traditional this for that. Hey, baby, I'll give you a promotion if you go sleep with me. Excuse the bluntness, but that's what it is. Or, you know, you can put in for a promotion if you do this for me in the office. If you don't do that, then I will give it to, you know, Joni, whatever over here. The employer does not need to be aware of this type of harassment and can still be liable because it's so egregious. Hostile work environment harassment means that the environment is so permeated, in fact the standard is permeated, continuous, hostile harassment based upon a protected category, that the person can't do their work in the environment. A reasonable person can't do their work.
Who defines that?
Who defines hostile work environment? It's basically if the person can't reasonably perform their job duties.
They define it. I mean, they define in their own right that it's harassment.
That's right. My supervisor is continually coming over and touching my shoulders, touching my my elbow, whatever, and we're going to talk about the different types, and that's impairing my ability to do my work. Now, the good thing is, if you notice from the last slide, it's the reasonable person standard. So if you have an eggshell plaintiff who's afraid every time the mail comes near her, that may not be what a reasonable person would feel under the same circumstances. But the hostile work environment must be permeated with the sexual or other harassing conduct.
So that has to be prevailing throughout the organization or just in that department?
No, just for that one person.
For that one person.
Right.
So
continuous and hostile.
The Qualcomm thing that's going on down there, that they had, what, about 50 women?
Lots of women.
Okay.
Now that's a different one. That's more what Bill's talking about. If the entire environment is discriminatory towards women, that's called disparate treatment. Women are treated differently by Qualcomm, or big case is Walmart that's coming up, because they were women. That's discrimination, but it may not be harassment. Harassment is either quid pro quo, you do this for that, or it's that this environment for this person or these persons is hostile because it's permeated with this, let's say, sexual harassment. Jim's laughing. He's thinking, at home, it's, no, never mind.
I'm just thinking, wow. I understand why they did it, okay? But why they allowed to continue for so long? Because I had heard that they've been doing that for years.
Right,
and
right.
And then finally somebody got up enough nerve to say, let's get together.
Right.
I was just laughing. It went on for so long because I can remember hearing about it like back in about 85.
Wow. At Qualcomm.
Yeah. Hmm.
All right. So the three types of harassment: verbal, that can be anything that comes out of your mouth, insults, derogatory comments. Hey, baby, you look fine today. Wouldn't you like to? You know, sexual innuendo. Physical, that's any kind of touching. That can be unwanted, so that could be overtly sexual or it could be very subtle. Unfortunately now people are being trained, don't pat anybody on the back. You know, don't touch anybody's hand. Definitely don't massage shoulders. We heard that a lot. Unnecessarily brushing against or blocking a person. I want to tell a little story about this because I represented an auto dealership. And out in the bay where the mechanics would go, It was all men. They talked about anything they wanted, including a lot of sexual innuendo. The dispatcher in a tiny little office about this size was the lone female who had contact with these mechanics. They'd come in, they'd get their orders, they'd fight over the orders, go back out, do the best jobs, try to get the most money. One particular mechanic really liked this woman, kept asking her out. She kept saying no. He'd sneak into the corner of her little dispatch area and brush against her. In fact, at one point he put his arm across her breast. And then he'd come around behind her. He'd block her way, and there was only one way out of her little dispatch area. So in that case, we had to settle the case quickly, because even just blocking someone's access when it's for a sexual purpose was determined to be harassment, sexual harassment, actionable harassment. The third kind is nonverbal, visual, and this is pervasive in, pervasive in the workplace today. It's not just the posters in the mechanics bays in the auto dealerships, which are mostly are gone, but are not completely gone. It's anything that's visual, including everything on the smartphone, everything on the computers. Texting, Instagram, Facebook, pulling up pictures has gone crazy. I represented two bank executives. One had been there 10 years, one had been there 25 years. Two women. A gay man had received a text on his phone, and all he said to them as he passed in the hall was, "I've got something HR should see." They didn't know what it was. They didn't know the content. These women were fired. And I'm going to tell you the background story. What had happened was one female had sent to her co-employee in the bank a text of a naked man saying, he wants you, to her. This other female, again, just the intended recipient, sent it off to the gay man and some other co-employees. Well, the gay man alleged that that was harassment based upon his gender, that he had been the victim of this text. He reported it to HR. HR went to these two women, who were supervisors over him, and the ladies, and asked if they had done an investigation. They said, no, we don't even know the content. Didn't matter, because it was, I believe, a gay man asking for help as a victim, both of them were terminated, lost their careers. Shortly thereafter, the gay man, who was not competent as a teller at the bank, was let go. But meanwhile, they'd lost their careers. All right, an actionable environment has to be, as we said, permeated with insults, abuse, sexually oriented conduct. Not just a mean boss. Harassment is not just being unreasonable or dumping work on somebody. All right, discrimination, again, is the umbrella. Harassment falls within the discrimination laws. In churches and other ministry organizations, we need to be sensitive to this. Internal conflicts, other things can lead to people feeling like they've been discriminated against. Rumors, inappropriate jokes and discussions, and it still goes on in our churches. The best way to handle this is, as employers, as church leaders, educate people. Talk to them about discrimination. Get a policy together. One of the handouts I have to send to you by email is a sample harassment policy, which I use for my ministry clients. It has the protected categories under Title VII. It has guidelines that's about 3 pages long on what is harassment, what is discrimination, and what is retaliation, and what is bullying. In California, we must train on abusive conduct and bullying, as well as harassment. Have a method by which people can come to somebody and complain. If they feel discrimination, they feel harassment, they need an open door. If it's not you as the lead pastor, then have an elder. Have some HR person, if you have a bigger staff, that they can go to. Because if they don't go to you, they're going to call the agency. And there's going to be an investigation by the EEOC or your state agency. And they're not going to be as favorable to you as if you'd handled it internally. If you want, you can have a sample complaint.
Another question for you.
Yeah, sure.
Back up one.
Sure.
If you wouldn't mind. When you're clarifying your retaliation against the employee,
taken them in for counseling. One counseling, two counselings, three or more.
Okay. Let's back up in the scenario. We're going to get to this eventually, but if let's say you've conducted your investigation. I'll be talking about that in a little bit. You determined that a woman was harassing a man in the workplace. Mm-hmm. You've got witnesses. They've said there's been harassment. So you determine we're going to discipline that woman. If it's mild harassment, if it's verbal statements, then it may be enough to do a written warning. I do recommend something in writing initially, because if you have a written policy that prohibits this and it can lead to a lawsuit, you got to get serious about it. If it's physical, you can terminate immediately. There's no law any longer that I know of, especially in California, that requires progressive discipline for this type of conduct. Anyone engaging in this type of conduct is potentially exposing your organization to liability. Someone files it with the EEOC, there's some kind of determination under Title VII, or even the agency investigates. And again, with our risk to our Christian organizations, you could still be sued. You could still pay $50,000 in lawyer's fees just to assert your religious rights. Mm-hmm. So some kind of discipline is necessary.
Would that have to be something that is, say, written up in your rules and regulations, or to give them an idea of what the latitude or the severity is going to be?
Yes. In my sample policy that I have for you, it basically describes exactly the type of conduct that must be prohibited. And then it says that this violation of this policy will lead to discipline, including and up to termination.
Okay.
If someone is disciplined in the workplace, let's say the woman is disciplined, but she goes back to work, she's not fired for harassing, she's going to be a scapegoat. She's going to be treated differently, probably, because there's going to be gossip. And you must encourage your staff not to retaliate against her or any other alleged perpetrator, and not to treat them differently, because if they do, then there's a potential claim for retaliation against someone.
No joke.
Okay. And then if the employer retaliates, if, for example, someone goes through a probationary period under a written warning. 6 months later, you know, they haven't engaged in any more harassment. Let's say 3 months later. It's close to the time they were disciplined. And then the employer suddenly terminates Susie Smith, who was the alleged harasser. They can form a claim for retaliation because they had completed their probationary period and they were still terminated. The victim who complains about the harassment, if they're treated differently because they complained about harassment, they're terminated or they're demoted, that's retaliation that they can claim. The employer retaliated against me for asserting my protected rights. Yes?
Yeah? So
sure.
This just applies to people under somebody's employer that is right, that would apply to members of the congregation.
Very good point. I'm talking today about discrimination laws which only govern employers and workplaces. Within the congregation, all of us have civil rights under the Civil Rights Act, but that would have to be with involving a public agency. So I think what you're asking is if there's harassment within your congregation, there could be a civil harassment claim, but it can only go through the police department. It's a very high standard of harassing to the point of threatening serious bodily harm, at least in California. In other words, you can't go to a court and sue somebody for harassing you in a congregation, for civil harassment.
But if you have one member who's threatening another member, it still doesn't apply, right?
No, if you have one member who's threatening another member, you may have the right to get a restraining order for civil harassment because serious bodily injury has been threatened. If you have abusive talk, get some Christian mediation, which we're going to be talking about in a few minutes. They need to learn to be like Christ. All right, so training we talked about. Training educates your staff in what to look for, what to prevent. If they see it happening between two co-employees, they can take action, take an investigation or discipline. What types of training does your church provide? We talked about this a little bit yesterday. How many of you get harassment and discrimination training by your churches? One. It's time. All right, it's part of safety training. I mean, it can be part of safety training. In California, we're required, all employers of 50 or more employees are required to have 2 hours or more of sexual harassment training. It can include abusive conduct training, and that's every 2 years for all managerial employees. Again, you should have documents. Supervisors need to discipline poor performance in the form of discrimination. And then put together your policy and follow your policy as you investigate. Lots of these are very specific. If you investigate, I'll give you a quick tip. You can remember, always have two people in the room when you're interviewing witnesses. If you can investigate a harassment complaint internally, have a supervisor, an HR person, can be the lead pastor if he or she is not the subject of the victim's complaint. But then there should be a second person, a secretary, someone to take notes, an independent witness who can testify about what was said. Be very fair, even to the harasser, the alleged harasser. All right, in California, we have a definition now in our statutes of abusive conduct. You can see that it's very, very broad. Derogatory remarks and insults. We now have to train every 2 years on preventing abusive conduct in the workplace and bullying. They do say a single act shall not constitute this abusive conduct, but I get 10 calls a week from employees who say they're in a hostile work environment at work, and it's because they have a mean boss or they don't want to do the work. And I can see those lawsuits are coming. Even someone who witnesses illegal harassment in the environment can bring a claim. At least in California, and in the EEOC regulations, someone can assist someone else in bringing a claim and become a victim. Is that clear? Okay. We had a case where, I think it's coming up actually. What's the complaint about? We won't talk about that. We've had a complaint where women within a probationary organization, probation system, were not getting promotions because other women who were sleeping with the head probationary officer were getting the promotions. So even though those women were not the victims of the direct sexual harassment, they brought a lawsuit and won a big judgment against the probation department because of conduct that was going on nearby in their same work environment. All right, so sexual harassment is a serious problem. Despite the fact that the claims are going down, employers paid over $35 million in 2014, but in the lawsuits, there's no cap on the amount that they can claim. You can claim $1 million against an employer. This is like the Qualcomm case, Jim. This is the largest fine that was imposed upon Walmart back in 2002, and this was one store director who went around and treated women differently, harassed different women, and $30.6 million. Was awarded
this
again.
This is Ralph, but it's true, I say Walmart.
Oh, I'm sorry, Ralph. This is the Ralph. There's another Walmart one. It's okay, the Ralph is the biggest one. Thank
Walmart
you, husband.
Being Ralph's villa.
Right. All right, so the key defense is if it's unwelcome or welcome. If someone consents to your sexual banter, then consent is a defense. The problem is proving it, right? All sexual harassment must be unwelcome, pervasive, and continuous. If someone engages in it and we have proof, especially through texting or some kind of email, then we can give you a defense. This is an interesting study. 95% of surveyed women were offended by suggestive comments. The men thought they were just flirting. All right, we talked about consent. How about relationships between people in your organization? Do you have romantic relationships that occur? I highly encourage you to discourage them. They often are consensual at first and then turn into something that's not consensual. All right, we'll get to this, co-employee relationships. Pop ahead. So what are your responsibilities as a leader of your religious organization? No one knows.
Yeah, I need
get on our knees. Thank you. That is the number one. All right, tell the harasser to stop, number one. 80% of the time that works. Supervisors under our laws are obligated to report harassment. If it continues, go through an investigation, who, what, where, when, how, why. And as an employee, as a Christian employee especially, set an example. Don't let gossip ensue. Don't let derogatory comments be perpetuated in the workplace. And follow the company policy, the organization's policy. Report it. Figure out a reporting system for your ministry. For failing to report, for reporting a false claim of harassment, there can be discipline. So you can work that into your policies. If someone's making stuff up,
that's kind of a little bit in the smoking in the mirror area, isn't it? I mean, you implied in the beginning that, what was it, 52% of the claims were unfounded?
That's right. And I suspect your ministries are going to have some unfounded claims. We'll move ahead to, I'll go back. There's a case called Cotran in California. And in that case, a man was accused by three women of engaging in harassment. Three women went to the employer and said, this man, Mr. Cotran, is harassing us. This is what he did. They provided lots of evidence. The employer terminated Mr. Cotran's employment. Mr. Cotran then sued for wrongful termination. During the course of the trial, the three women recanted their stories. They had made it all up. Now he'd been terminated, right? He gets his job back. He gets hundreds of thousands of dollars in damages. No. The court held that because the employer conducted an investigation, went to the witnesses, took the statements, and it was a complete and thorough investigation, he didn't get his job back and he didn't get any reward.
Even though it was false testimony?
Yes.
So what happened to the lady?
Well, we don't know. That wasn't the subject of the judgment. But I would think they can be terminated.
Right?
They should be terminated. They submitted false reports.
Okay.
And he got no compensation even though it proved there was false claims made against him?
That's right.
Well, because it was the employer that was being protected, and the employer did the investigation. And it was the ladies who were the criminals, the employer.
Right, the employer acted upon reasonable investigation.
So upon finding that, could he re-engage in a civil lawsuit against the three ladies who cost him the job?
Presumably he could. Okay. I mean, you could sue them for defamation or some other personal tort.
Mm-hmm. It was definitely
yes.
Injury.
But that's why the investigation is so key. Don't disregard somebody's complaints. Even in the congregation, of course, we should be mediating, conciliating disputes. But take these kinds of claims seriously. Possible claims include failure to prevent harassment. Many employers don't think about that. You've got to actively train your employees, or that kind of claim could show up. Emotional distress. If someone's emotionally distressed by the employer's response or lack of response, that person can sue. And that, by the way, emotional distress is not protected for religious entities. If an employee or even another, let's say a contractor or someone involved with a religious entity or some people from a religious entity determines that they have emotional distress based upon the tortious conduct of someone in the entity, someone in the organization, they can sue regardless of all these laws. You can sue for intentional infliction of emotional distress. We talked about supervisors and harassing co-employees can be personally liable. How about friendships? How about counseling relationships within your church? Are they okay?
They must be protected, aren't they?
They're protected, but how many times, if we're going to get to a slide soon, we looked at it yesterday, sexual abuse of a minor is a key claim.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard a lot of stories about women who have claimed that the pastor did something in the closed door, closed room, during counseling. Is counseling protected? I don't think so. There could be harassment claims. Those would not be based in employment, I presume, but secretaries of pastors have certainly sued. All right, damages can include compensatory damages or something that compensates the victim, as well as punitive punishment for the employer who does not protect the victims. We talked about pain and suffering, well, emotional distress, and jobs. So ways to prevent harassment in your organizations. Communicate the policy. Make sure there's a complaint procedure, somebody to go to. Be committed to either separating the people, remedying the situation, protecting the victim, and then be cooperative without any retaliation. It's a tall standard. I suggest a background check policy for all of your ministries. You need to know if someone's harassed in the past, if someone's engaged in sexual abuse in the past, and you can find that out. Check the sexual offender registry before you have people come into your church and even take over adult ministries.
You can't necessarily find that out, though.
The sexual offender registry, I believe, is public.
The registry you can, but mm-hmm. there have been things that all of a sudden, you're trying to do a reference check, it's been there, and you're not going to get your information, it gets passed on. So mm-hmm. it's not as easy to find as we think.
You're absolutely right. In fact, I know an experience that you're talking about, but with employees, you can require background checks.
Or the background check, but maybe you're not sure.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because
and
somebody
had
to sign papers, you know.
Settlement agreement is confidential. That's right. I will often, if I suspect something, I might search the courts. You can look up a person's name in the courts online. L.A. County Superior Court, Riverside County Superior Court. You can look that person's name up and see if they've ever been involved in lawsuits.
So it's a good idea to do background checks on employees as well as volunteers.
Right. In fact, contractors.
Contractors.
I know churches that have not allowed cell tower companies or other construction companies to come on site unless those companies promise to get a background check and clear all their employees before they work on the church premises. You can require that in your independent contractor agreements. Here's some ideas. Include the spouse of any applicant in an interview. Not that they're going to come out and say, my husband's a harasser. but you'll get a more of a sense than if you just get someone's paper through the internet. The background check agent.
What jobs can you do that for? Back to the spouse of the applicant.
You can, as a religious entity, you can set up your
any job
process.
But any job or basically pastoral job?
And this is mainly for pastoral. This is for ministry positions. Again, non-ministerial would be covered by the discrimination laws, so you'd have to be careful about saying you can't be a janitor without me checking out your wife.
Or, right.
Here are some, I think I shepherded this still wrong, there are some background check organizations specifically for ministries. Handle it with confidentiality. Keep everything private. Otherwise, you're looking at, again, defamation, libel, slander suits. Those are all private. All right, a church employment agreement, a covenant. At a minimum, have an employee lifestyle policy. We talked about this yesterday. Have some kind of policy that restricts the person's lifestyle as long as they are employed to a biblical lifestyle. I'm including in the handout a sample we talked about yesterday from the ACSI folks, a sample lifestyle statement. You can fashion it for your own ministry, your own doctrine of faith, but then the person signs that. As I mentioned, I had a church who had hired a person. She'd signed that lifestyle statement and then determined that she needed to pray to Mecca. I've had people sign that, and then all of a sudden they start showing up with their lesbian partner at the church functions. So at least if it's signed, you have a right to say, we told you who we are, you agreed to our statement of faith, your lifestyle is not matching, and we can take action. Anti-harassment policy, I'm providing a sample. I recommend that you include provisions on bullying and abusive conduct because those should be avoided in a church and a ministry anyway. Computer technology policy, we talked about this briefly yesterday, but yours should specifically prohibit harassment and discrimination. So you can't send emails with funny jokes that are off color. I recommend an equal opportunity employment policy, and that's even for churches and ministries. So you have at least the categories protected by Title VII. We do not discriminate in our hiring based upon age, gender, again, genders, male, female, you know, or other limited categories.
First, it may in a pastoral position.
On gender, yes, anything, well, again, that's a ministerial position, right, along with your statement of faith. You have a right to discriminate, and they don't have a right to bring a lawsuit yet. Handbook, employee handbooks. Dispute resolution between employees is a very valid method for avoiding it. Follow your process. Communicate the results to the parties. If you determine that someone is, there's insufficient evidence of harassment, communicate that to both sides. If there's sufficient evidence of harassment, go to the victim. Say, we've concluded our investigation. We've taken appropriate action.
They don't have to know what that action is.
They don't. They'll see it if the person's terminated. Other than that, they probably would not. But you can demote. You can move them to a different department.
I guess stock.
What's that? Stocks? No. Stocks and barrels? No, not anymore.
You know, they'll Puritan.
Sure. Right, right. All right, essentially you want to make the victim whole. If it's necessary to separate two people, if they can't work in the same ministry, if they can't work in the same building, do what you need to do to keep both people employed if you've decided to do that, but protect the victim. And then follow up with the victim. Several months later, ask how are you feeling about this? Did you feel that we handled it appropriately? Are you still being harassed? Keep the open door. Otherwise, they could go to the agency and file a complaint. Establish clear policies, obviously, for counselors, ministry workers, youth leaders. Otherwise, you could have harassment and discrimination claims. Oh, interesting one is there. children, youth, ministry guidelines are always a good idea. And then after the remedial action, of course, treat people fairly. All right, current developments. I wanted to talk to you about the statute, which we did, the unmarried pastor, the ministerial exception, and we have one case in which the Lutheran Church was sued for not complying with city regulations. This was in Montana, and the city then cut off their funding. The Lutheran organization said, well, that's discrimination. We should be able to get the funding for our playgrounds to be safe. And the U.S. Supreme Court ruled against the church because the church wasn't complying with the city regulations. It couldn't get funding. That's outside the employment sphere, but again, just shows that religious entities are not immune from governmental action. I did talk about Southwest yesterday, but I could. Yesterday we showed the slide, top five reasons churches end up in court. Sexual abuse of a minor is number one for years. So have policies in place. 3 miles from us is the Southwest Church. We talked about this briefly yesterday, but this is when a pastor determined that he would not follow the elder's direction and the position paper on homosexuality and human sexuality and was terminated. He hasn't sued. I mean, he was terminated. He has not brought an action yet. But his position was ministerial, so I don't believe he could successfully sue. All right, any questions?
His church was pilloried by the press, I'm sure.
It was.
Absolutely.
It was.
Protesters, demonstrations.
It apparently has got national. It is a large church in TV3.
I think I saw, I don't know where I saw it. It wasn't a documentary, but it was that very case. And he was painted as being just a great guy. Following his heart.
By the objective press, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, I have lots of war stories about secular organizations. We've had some interesting cases. I've represented a gay man, a lesbian woman, against an LGBT organization because they discriminated based upon their gender, believe it or not. The gay men were running the organization and discriminated against the lesbian woman. Her friend, the gay guy, complained to the administration, and he was terminated as well. So so we had a nice lawsuit about that. Very complicated. It was almost 2 years long.
Karen, not related to employment, but how do we address as a church some of the questions that are going to come up of marriage?
Okay. Right.
I don't know if you're going to address that today or
not. All right. Let's see if I did. I did yesterday, but let's talk about it again. Yesterday I'll just briefly describe, and I can get you the handouts as well. I have a, we want the lifestyle policy, we want a position paper on same sex, and then for boards and governing documents, I recommend a facilities use agreement, a facilities use policy, which I can provide, that says that our facilities won't be used for that purpose, and then even applications for weddings.
Right. Okay.
That kind of thing should include that this is our statement of faith. I recommended yesterday pass out your statement of faith to everyone who's in your congregation. Let them know where it is. Let them know your position on same-sex marriage so that if the media inquires, they have a response or they have someone, you know, go see Bill. He's going to a designated person to discuss the topic.
Preston, always try to talk to somebody other than the person you want them to talk to.
Right, and the press will try to catch ministries off guard, catch the little person over in the corner. What else? What else can I answer?
What's your view on churches hiring employees that are neither church members nor Christian?
Then they wouldn't sign your statement of faith. I mean, for most of my ministries, everyone signs a statement of faith. When you're hiring, you can require that. If you choose not to, then be advised that we have a Catholic high school near us, and they hire anybody who wants to work there. So they came to me recently and asked for a handbook and all these documents, and I said, well, don't you want Christian dispute resolution? Well, we can't do that. We have Jewish people, and we have, you know, Islam represented, and well, then you also have no religious protection. You have no ministerial protection. And if you do decide to hire people who are going to need to pray to Mecca a few times a day, or people who are going to have different lifestyles, then it's going to invade your ministry.
If you hire them as a non-Christian, and then they become Muslim, then you've got no recourse.
Right, you have to protect them.
Except to accommodate.
It's often said that in hiring, you have a lot of leeway as a Christian organization. In firing, it's where it gets sticky.
Yep.
Again, the lady who needed to pray to Mecca, even the lesbian woman who started bringing her partner on site, is very sticky to say, well, we know what you do in your private times, and therefore we're going to, you know, pursue your termination.
So, can you be emailing out?
Yes,
yesterday and
today's, yes.
Everybody signed the
clipboard.
Should be this week.
Okay.
This week. In fact, my secretary is ready to go. We will send the PowerPoint from yesterday that lists all the corporate documents because I want everybody to have those and share that. This one I will not send. It's very California specific, but I'm going to send all the handouts, which is a sample policies. They can go right into your handbooks because they can be separate. They can post them on the wall.
If you don't get it by Monday, it'll be a couple of weeks because they'll be out of country.
No, I'm going to have the secretary send them.
I know for a long time, churches and nonprofits that were Christian-based were basically saying, well, we just have to affirm a statement that says we're Christian. And they were talking about that framework.
Mm-hmm.
But it just seems to me more and more they're being encouraged to have a policy in their organization somehow that also says you're going to affirm this, our stance on the homosexuality issue ahead of time before they hire them. And that never, you used to be able to say, oh, as long as you say you're Christian. Well, that's nice, but now there's that division that makes it even murkier.
Right.
Because some Christian churches are standing up and saying, we want to support this. So you really need to be clear on making sure you have a policy about that the church affirms, I think.
Right. That's what we discussed yesterday. The church has to affirm it needs to be, should be in your bylaws, constitution,
right,
in a separate same-sex position paper, or human sexuality position paper. All employees should sign, you know, the lifestyle and employment handbook with the policies. Mm-hmm. Document as much as you can.
Right. It's just too general now.
It's way too general.
For many people, there's only, if you're not a Muslim, then you are a Christian. It's the only two things there are. Well, that's not right.
Right, right.
Even in the press, that's the way it seems to be.
Even Catholic hospitals have been sued for years based upon terminating somebody for proselytizing in the hallway. That the person would sue for wrongful termination, and the Catholic hospitals have had to pay because their doctrine, their general doctrine is, hey, we're Catholic. You know, we have Christian values, but they don't have the documentation in place to protect themselves.
The lifestyle can be used for any job?
It can be upon hiring.
Upon hiring?
Right.
Okay. But if they change their lifestyle in the middle...
Then again, my position is, representing Christian nonprofits, is that you can say, you signed this lifestyle statement. We know you're living with your boyfriend, or you've just become pregnant as a single woman, or you keep bringing your... Yes, whatever. And therefore you violated this lifestyle. You can discipline them. I mean, not only discipline, really, is to terminate their employment. They aren't following your statement of faith. The risk is that they can come back and say, but I was a janitor. I wasn't a ministerial position.
Right.
So it's the document protects you.
Much less protective for non-ministerial employees. The employer is much less, the church is much less protected if they're non-ministerial.
That's right.
Okay.
And a few years ago I would have said, you're protected, you can enforce that lifestyle statement across the board, and these recent decisions are setting up that distinction between ministerial and non-ministerial, and now invading even that.
Yeah. What about membership issues? If somebody violates, we don't have particular code of ethics.
Yeah, and the Peacemaker Ministries, that brings up another topic of the Christian dispute resolution. Peacemaker Ministries recommends that every membership covenant be in writing, that the members sign a covenant that includes the agreement with the statement of faith. You could certainly include a lifestyle statement, and you can include a Christian dispute resolution document, which I'm going to provide to you, which says you can't go to the courts and sue each other or sue the church. You need first to try Christian conciliation, Christian mediation, and Christian arbitration because you've signed on this contract to do so and not resort to the courts.
Our bylaws also have statements for removal from membership, removal from position as a deacon, a deaconess, or elder.
Our pastor has up to the very broad.
Ours is these things you can mm-hmm.
So you may want to use the lifestyle statement and incorporate it into a member contract. That's what Peacemaker has recommended.
We just had a situation where someone left and did join the church down south. They since become transgender. They could be able to move back and want to resume his membership.
Yeah.
You were saying for the person who you're hiring to sign the lifestyle affirmation or whatever. What about for the existing employees, existing independent contractors, sponsors? Can you also start to have them sign the document?
That's a great question. What I do when I give an employer a new handbook is I say, you come up with a handbook, your Christian conciliation agreement, your lifestyle statement, and tell everyone we're instituting new policies. They're effective as of August 1st. Everyone will need to sign these. You'll get some pushback. You could get some pushback. Wait a minute, I'm employed here. I shouldn't have to change my doctrine or my beliefs. It gets sticky. If it's an employment requirement of remaining employed, you can draw the line there, and then if someone can't agree, then they are not agreeing with your statement of faith. So you can introduce new policies. I'd be careful about terminating someone who didn't agree. I'd get legal opinion from a lawyer before you terminate someone for not signing the document. Tim?
About a year and a half ago, I had thoughts. Actually, I did actually contact the ACLJ concerning a matter that was going on between our church and our town. And I really thought I wanted them to pursue it. But the issue behind it was is that if they make you sign an agreement that if they decide that they're going to take the case on, then they also want permission to be able to publicize it. Right? Not only locally, but even potentially nationally. And that kind of scared me away because this was just a small town issue, you know, between the church and the town. And I thought, I'm going to back off on this. And I didn't pursue it. Sometimes I wonder, maybe I should have. But,
little issues can become big in the media so fast.
Yeah. So I haven't, but it still bothers me.
Understood.
The issue bothers me.
All right, if there are no further questions, I thank you very much for attending.
Thank you.
Keep in touch with me if you need anything. Consult your local lawyer for your best advice.